Welcome to This Wild Life, a conservation podcast that brings you up to date with frontline conservation efforts from around the world. Expect stories of wild adventures and get to know the characters who are dedicating their lives to protect our beautiful planet. We're here to bring the wild to you. Hello to all of our wonderful listeners. As you can hear, today we are taking to the skies with helicopter pilot and helicopter wildlife capture specialist Mike Ross. Now, you've probably seen footage of helicopters being flung around the skies, often with a vet in the back, trying to dart a rhino or pushing impala into a boma, but it's quite rare to be able to speak to the pilots themselves. But today we have that opportunity, and I'm sure it's going to be a fascinating episode. So Mike has over 20 years experience working in both North America and South Africa as a helicopter wildlife capture specialist. And today we'll be chatting to him about all sorts, from why helicopter capture is really, really necessary in this day and age of conservation, the extreme mental challenges of doing this job, and also we'll be getting into some of the differences of capturing different species and why they require slightly different techniques. So let's get into it. As usual, I'm your host, Amy Turner, and Mike, a very, very warm welcome onto the show.
Well, thank you very much, Amy. I really appreciate the opportunity and to be here talking to you. Thank you.
It's a complete pleasure to have you here. So firstly, I'd be really keen to hear a little bit about your background and how you came to work as a helicopter wildlife capture specialist.
It actually started from a young age. When I was a kid, I actually had a passion for wildlife. I used to go out and catch snakes and sell them to my friends at school that used to collect snakes, and we used to collect snakes, and I used to go and raid birds' nests and bring them home and raise them. So it was just an interest from very young age. And then, when I was at school, you know, one had to choose subjects for your career. And, you know, like a lot of young kids didn't know what they wanted to do, but I knew that I wanted to get into, you know, wildlife conservation from a very early age. So that's what I did. I was introduced actually animals to put on a property. And through that, the guy that bought them asked for a certain species, and I said, yes, I can get them. And then I went on some captures with him, and I absolutely loved it. That was, in the mid-1990s. And then from there, I just, you know, decided that's the route I'm going to go. That's basically how I got into wildlife capture, and then to get into helicopter flying. So obviously, I started my own capture team. I did a dangerous drugs course in 1998. With a very well-known veterinarian, Dr. Kubus Rath. There is a little market for game ranchers and us wildlife guys to actually, you know, catch our own animals chemically. And back then, the whole regulations of the drugs weren't as regulated as they are today. But it was through that, you know, the capturing. And then I had my own capture crew, I had my own trucks, and I used to do the capturing. And then I had pilots that had a contract for me, and some pilots knew how to catch animals, and other pilots couldn't tell the difference between an impala and a blesbuck. And a pilot can make or break a capture. And pilots need to learn all the little idiosyncrasies on the animals, and they need to learn how to, you know, identify capture myopathy, stress, both physical and psychological, in an animal. So, you know, they can either, you know, cause animals to die from stress and cause injuries and things. And we call it live animal capture for a reason, you know, because you're trying to catch and relocate the animal. So Nonetheless, it was through that that I decided that I was going to become a helicopter pilot. So I ended up doing my license and bought a helicopter and started flying. And I think, you know, having a lot of the ground experience, you know, working on the ground for many years, you know, 10, 12 years, running the trucks, building the capture sites, being in the helicopter, darting, doing the neck gunning, I had a fantastic ground base. So when I became the helicopter pilot, I understood everything that went on the ground. And that's what a lot of people are looking for. You know, some pilots, their passion is to become a, aviator to become a pilot, and they don't really know wildlife. I'm a wildlife capture specialist using the helicopter as a tool in my trade. So yeah, that's how I got into it.
Okay. And so what is the reasoning behind having to capture these animals? I mean, I understand it is really key in modern day conservation, but if you could tell us a little bit more about that, that would be great.
So there's a bunch of different things that we actually do. There's capture and relocation. So here in South Africa, the wildlife industry is a big industry. And wildlife is Africa's natural asset, if you think about it. I mean, you know, wildlife was here before domestic stock kind of came, and it's been around here and it's everywhere. And, you know, a lot of areas were turned into, you know, domestic stock breeding, cattle, sheep, you name it. And people actually started finding that there was a need to conserve wildlife and go back to ranching wildlife. You know, there's all sorts of different diseases that you've got to dip cattle for and, you know, inject them and et cetera, but you don't have to for wildlife. So, which was great. So wildlife, a lot of ranches have been turned back into wildlife habitat, so to speak. And through that, you know, obviously as humans have taken over the world and we've chopped up the land into small pieces, a lot of the reserves here in South Africa are half fenced. They've got fences around them. Some are small, some are large. But within those areas, management has to take place. Basically, you know, there has to be an equilibrium between, you know, fauna and flora. You know, you've got bushfires, you've got browsing, you've got grazing, and you've got animals in there, different species, and you have to keep it all at an equilibrium. So, you know, animals don't starve or overgraze, and, you know, the prevention of disease, et cetera, et cetera. So that's where the management comes in, and there's different forms of management. You know, there's venison market for culling venison and selling the meat. There's the trophy market, and there's capture. And capture can be done very quickly and fast with, you know, a minimal impact, you know, on the reserve over an extended period of time. So basically, when some of these ranches have too many animals, they have to be caught and removed for that management purpose. All the surplus animals have to be taken off. Not only that, there's times where, you know, new blood has to be brought into some of these areas, as, you know, because of the enclosed areas. You know, and then on the bigger areas, you know, also here in, you know, South Africa, Botswana, Namibia, and, you know, North America, you've got massive areas. And, you know, within those areas, again, you've got human interaction. You know, you're building new cities and you're building towns and you're pushing roads through areas and, you know, you're affecting migration routes. And, you know, some years you find that certain disease or drought may be affecting a certain species or, you know, different age group within a species. So that comes down to this, you know, the science behind it. So there we're actually catching wildlife and we're putting collars on them and, you know, they're being monitored and we're testing for disease, et cetera, et cetera. So there's many different aspects why animals have to be caught, but it all comes down to basically, you know, preserving species and habitat and species within habitat, you know, because often, you know, often people will say, you know, let's save a rhino or save the lion. But at the end of the day, you actually have to save the habitat, you know, because as humans are encroaching the habitat, you need to look after the habitat. And then the bigger your ecosystem is, the less management it needs, the smaller it is, the more management it needs. So, yeah, so one of the ways to do it is through, you know, to study these animals and is through capturing them. So, and there's different forms of capture. And one of them, obviously, is aerial capture when you get helicopters involved because it just, it's more manageable from the aspect where you can locate the animals, you can get them into an area where it's easier to work with them. You can work with them at certain times of the year when it's not as hot, when there's less foliage on the thing. So, but yeah, so those are the basically the reasons why animals have to be caught.
Okay, some really interesting points. And in terms of the ways in which you capture these animals, I'm sure most people have seen, yeah, a vet hanging out the side of a helicopter looking to dart a rhino or an elephant. But I gather there are different types of ways to capture these animals. So perhaps you could give us a little bit of an overview of that.
Yeah, certainly. So here in Africa, there's a lot of what we call mass capture or boma capture. Corral capture is what the Americans call it. So we build these big capture corals using poles, and we put these cables up and we hang capture plastic, which is basically a geotextile, you know, sheeting with, you know, static curtains and running curtains. And, you know, that can be anything like from 200 to 300-400 meters long, you know, 200-300 meters in the front. It just depends. You've got to build a proportion. You're almost like a ice cream cone shape effectively, but, you know, we vary the different capture bomas depending on the area, the topography, the terrain, the species being caught. So, and that's a very effective form of capture. So where you're catching animals that are pretty gregarious, like impala and wildebeest and blesbuck and zebra and eland, you know, you can actually catch whole herds at a time in these capture corrals, put them up the loading ramps and into the trucks, or divert them into like crushers, you know, if you want to pull out individuals and then release them again, but for relocation purposes. And it's quite quick and less invasive on the species, so to speak, you know, because you're getting a whole herd in there. A good capture pilot will know how to work them, know how to herd them, bring them in gently, and then push them up. So boma capture, in a nutshell, is to be able, allows us to catch a lot of animals quickly and big herds. And then we've also got net gun capture. Net gun capture was actually invented by the New Zealanders, primarily because of the terrain. You know, they're catching in the mountain areas mostly, where you can't build these captures, corrals or bomas, and you know, chemical capture is not really effective, because once you've darted an animal, you need that instant mobilization in the mountains, because if you dart it 5 minutes later, fallen off a cliff or gone into some deep timber, and you can't recover them, you know, to the animal's detriment. So so here in South Africa, it's getting more and more popular. I actually started pushing that myself many years ago, because there are certain species that actually react very well to net gun capture. And especially if you want to take out individual animals, the cost is also cheaper, you know, than chemical capture, because, you know, the drugs and the veterinarians and things can get quite expensive, especially here, you know, where you're actually buying and trading. And then in North America, we use net gun capture, again, because of we're catching 95% in mountainous terrain, and where the capture corals or chemical capture aren't as effective. So those are your three main forms of capture. And then there's also a form of capture called passive capture, where you can build a passive capture site, whether it's a passive capture boma or a drop net, and you actually feed the animals in. So it takes longer, but it's for an individual or for ranchers that actually have time on their hands and can manipulate water and food source and bring them in and capture them. So, but it just takes a longer time, and it's not as quick. So, you know, if somebody wants to get game caught quickly, chemical capture, mass capture, or net gun capture is the way to go.
Okay. And actually, for our listeners at home, Mike has been involved with the capture of both a rhino and a cheetah just today. So, Mike, I gather both of these are chemical capture.
Absolutely. So, you know, obviously being a cheetah, you could put a net on it, but it'll be too stressful for it, and both dangerous for the people handling it. There are techniques, you know, North America, we net coyotes, we net wolves, but they react differently when they're put into a net than a cat does. So the better option, and that's another thing when it comes to wildlife capture, there's no definitive method of, yeah, this is what's going to happen. You know, we could go to a capture and we can use all three different methods on that capture depending on the species, the terrain, and the need. So for the cheetah, certainly, yeah, you dart them and it's nice and soft and the animals, they go to sleep. You can get them safely, work with them safely for their sake and the human sake. And then certainly on rhino, it's a massive animal. So the only way to catch that animal is, you know, with chemical capture. And these days, you know, a lot of these vets, wildlife veterinarians and scientists, you know, and chemists that are working with the drugs put a lot of work into it. So there's different cocktails and combinations that when you're working with animals like rhino, get them down quickly. There's drugs that you can put in the cocktail that allow the animals to breathe better, better oxygen running through the system. And it's fantastic. So, yeah, so both those species that we caught today, we used chemical capture. Yeah.
To be honest, not to laugh, but I think you'd need a blimmin' big net for a rhino.
Absolutely. But I'll tell you what, and I kid you not, we actually have, I manufacture net guns too, but we've got a big 15-foot net and a 4.5 by 4.5 meter net. And when you're catching white rhino, they actually respond to the helicopter pretty well and they go down relatively quickly. But a black rhino is not like a white rhino. And when it darts, it just goes. And once it gets into that state of ataxia, it's very difficult to control it. So like this ranch that we're catching today, it's a big 10,000 hectare, 22,000 hectare reserve, lots of valleys, rivers, dams. So a lot of places for black rhino to go into. So it's one of those where you can actually put a dart in it, but if the animal's getting to an area where it's going to fall down a ravine or go into water and it's not responding to the helicopter, you can actually throw a net on it just to mobilize it right there and stop it. But yes, I certainly wouldn't want to do it without any sort of chemicals in it. It'll teach you a lesson. I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen that movie Hatari, where they used to chase them down in Land Rovers and put lassos around the necks and then rope them in. But there was a high mortality to the animals because it's extremely stressful. So it can be done, but it's certainly not the desired method at all these days. Yeah.
And I must say, from what I've seen of snippets from wildlife capture on documentaries, it does look a little bit like organized chaos, with ropes, people running to the animal, vehicles on the ground, and a helicopter that looks like it's going every which way and just skimming the trees at times. So on a capture, apart from just keeping the helicopter in the air, what is your main role?
No, absolutely. So as a capture pilot, there's a lot. So a lot that goes through your mind, a lot of concentration, a lot of knowledge that's needed to be a capture pilot. And it takes many years. It doesn't take many years. It takes a lot of experience. And like I mentioned earlier on, it's always advisable, and that's why capture pilots that have worked on the ground for many years, obtaining that experience, are more sought after, as opposed to somebody that's a pilot, never worked with wildlife, and then you want to work with wildlife. That's why we get a lot of calls from people saying, oh, how do you get into this industry? We'd love to become a capture pilot. It's very difficult because nobody wants to use you unless you've got a lot of experience working with wildlife. So in some areas they will, from a capture pilot perspective, it depends on what sort of capture you're doing. But so when it comes to mass capture, you've got the whole crew that builds the boma, and they actually erect the boma and pull the trucks into place and have everything ready. And actually one of my associates, who I never met personally but knew of him, he actually got killed. He fell out of a helicopter darting. It was very tragic, actually. He actually had an expression, which is very appropriate. Mass capture is hours and hours of boredom with moments of sheer panic. So basically, while they are sitting behind the curtains in the boma, waiting for the animals to come in, that's exactly it. They're sitting waiting and waiting. The pilot is out there working constantly. He's finding the animals, keeping a relation to where the boma is, where the animals are. You don't want to go too far. You don't want to push them too hard. And then he's got to herd them and bring them nicely and gently, keep the herds together. Because depending if you're catching impala, hemsprock, red hartebeest, whatever, if you put too much pressure on them, they're going to split and you've actually just, wasted a whole herd. And it's chopper time. It's very expensive. And then you've got to go back and find another herd. So, and there's a lot of concentration flying, because you've got to look at the animals. You've got to be able to read the animals. Like if it's impala and you've got a female that wants to break off the front of the herd or the back of the herd, you've got to stop them and read them. And, if one animal goes, all of them are going to follow as well. So you kind of let the one go in the direction of the boma. It doesn't have to be exactly. And then you can manipulate them. You can also, you don't want to force them against a place they don't really want to go. So you're going to kind of get them on a path that leads them in there, so a natural flight path. There's a lot that you need to be thinking of, and at the same time, there's often you have to get close to them, down into the trees, because if they're stopped in the trees, you got to watch your rotor blades, you got to watch your main rotor blades, your tail rotor blades, you got to watch your power, So there's a lot of concentration. You've got to whip it around, fly more aggressively to get them going, know when to use your siren, when not to use it, so they don't get used to the siren, and you need to use it just before the boma, you know, when to put the pressure on. So there's a lot of work. And then once they get into the boma, you've got to make sure they get into the boma. That's the whole objective. You know, you could have been working with a herd of impala, whatever, for like 40 minutes, and then they get to the boma. You also want to call the boma ahead and see what the wind direction is doing, because you're always working with the tailwind, which when it comes to helicopter capture, you know, you always want to work into the wind. You know, wind can be your enemy or can be your best friend, how you work with it. So with boma capture, you're always working with it on the tail, and it's not great. So you've got to watch that. And you've got to make sure that the wind's blowing into the boma as you bring the animal. So you don't want a herd of impala or wildebeest or anything that's, or zebra in particular, that might jump at the cable and smell it, and then they just bombshell right in front of it. And then, you know, there's, you know, thousands of rands of dollars spent getting a herd. You've got to go back, because then the guys that own the capture crew then are paying for the animals. You know, it just cost them a lot more money. So there's a lot of pressure from that side, on the financial side. But basically, once you get into the boma, you put the siren, you get the siren to close, you've got to keep the animals from escaping from the boma. If the curtains, you know, are lengthy curtains, or if the wind's blowing and it's going to, you know, cause more strain to close the bomas, or maybe a curtain got hooked up on a thorn bush and you've got to kind of hold the animals in the boma and not put too much downdraft so they can close it. There's a lot going on. And it's suddenly the concentration of keeping them in, keeping everybody happy, keeping the animals not crashing, and then getting them to the front of the boma, to the last kind of curtain, gently pulling away so that then the ground crew can kind of handle them from the ground. And they got their plastic and they've got to get them loaded and then into the truck with minimal stress. And that's the whole thing. It's always minimizing the stress on the animal. So that's boma capture. Chemical capture, a little bit more straightforward. So you've got a vet in the helicopter, and you know, you've got to make sure he's either sitting behind you or next to you. So you're watching out for him, making sure he's tethered in with his harness. You've got to make sure that there's no loose caps, you know, that he's had on his head and it's going to fly off into your tail rotor. You've got to make sure that he doesn't accidentally, while he's loading a dart in the back, you know, make a mistake and spray you. So you kind of want to fly a little bit more steady so you can load his dart. You know, some people land and let the vets load their dart on the ground. It just depends on what you're catching and the scenario. And then also depends on the species, because, you know, obviously when you're working with things like black rhino and difficult habitat, your pressures are high because it's a flagship species, you know, black rhino. You know, when things should go wrong, and they do go wrong sometimes. So, you know, there's the pressure of, you know, the vet doing his job. There's a pressure that us as the pilot, myself as a pilot, getting him into location, getting the animal into the right area, you know, getting the dart and judging when he's going to start getting into a form of ataxia, you know, slowing up, trying to keep him close to the road so that when he does go down right next to the road, the ground crew can be right there. You've got to coordinate the ground crew to make sure they're where the animal goes down. You've got to get the vet off if the ground crew don't make it fast enough so he can attend to that animal that's on the ground now. So, yeah, there's a lot of stress, a lot of concentration all the time. And the same, so with net gun capture, people say it's the most dangerous form of capture because you fly very low. You're firing a net out of a helicopter. You've got weights that can hit your skids. You can go into your tail rotor. You can go into your main rotor blades. So your net gunner has to really be on the ball. And there's some basics to net gunning. And as long as everybody adheres to those basics, 9 times out of 10, things will go well. But again, you know, when you're working in difficult terrain and you're trying to catch species that, you know, a little bit more tricky to catch, like you're trying to collar what we call recaptures. We're catching deer that we've collared already and they've been educated by the helicopter. You know, you really got to do some fancy flying, get down low, and you start, you know, got to take some fancy shots with the net gunning. So net gun capture, a lot of concentration and constantly being aware of safety, making sure that you're not putting a tail rod into the top of a tree, your blaze into a tree, the net gunner's going to shoot at the right moment. So there's a hell of a lot going on. So
you must be absolutely whacked by the time you finish a capture. You know, I must say it must be a big strain.
So, Amy, that's actually It's a very good thing of you to say there or acknowledge. So, and I was going to mention it earlier on. So, on my net gunning crew, they are physically tired at the end of the day because they're jumping in and out the helicopter and they're handling big animals like bison and moose and elk. And often, my guys are really good and they can handle the elk bites by themselves, moose by themselves sometimes too. So, it's very physical. For us pilots, it's mentally exhausting. So, and that's why, there's rules and regulations where we have to fly for X amount of hours per day. We need, to have a rest. The great thing about the people that we work with, especially in the States, because there we're flying long hours. We're flying from sun up to sunset all day long. And safety comes first. That's priority. No animal's life is worth more than a human's life, so to speak. So if we get into some really dangerous, because this is dangerous occupation, if we get into some dangerous terrain and scenarios, it is what it is. We've got to back off. But yeah, as the pilot, you're exhausted at the end of the day, mentally exhausted. So it's good to have a good sleep, get some energy, take a rest. And if, it could be a day where we've got fantastic weather, the sun is shining, and we're all tired, we'll call a rest day, all take a rest that day, refresh ourselves and go again. So yeah, it's very mentally exhausting for pilots, yeah.
And from my own interest with a background in psychology, and a lot of the research that I looked at during my master's was on the cognitive loading of military pilots. And I can see why this job that you do is such a dangerous occupation and requires just this huge level of cognitive workload. It's pretty incredible. Now, moving on to my next question. You've said you work in both Africa and North America. Is there perhaps one location that's easier to work than the other?
So here in South Africa, the flying conditions are easier because most of the time, we're flying in African bushveld. The elevations aren't very high. The highest you're probably going to catch it on average is about 6,000 to 6,500 feet. Or I say I lie. On average, you're working at about 4,500 feet. Some places depends where you're working. It's pretty geographic here in South Africa, where some capture crews will work in like KZN and some will be in the Limpopo and the Lowveld and then in the Free State. So some pilots will constantly fly at 4,000 feet. Some pilots will only be flying at 1,000 feet, some less than 1,000 feet. It just depends where they're stationed. So the flying side is the terrain is pretty easy. Occasionally we've got to catch in the mountains and things. Yes, we've got a lot more bush to deal with and what have you. But yeah, the flying is not too bad at all. Compared to America, the species here is a different story. Here we're working with 20 different, 23 different species of antelope. Not that we're catching the little ones with a helicopter, but you on a given day you can be catching on a game ranch or game, conservation area. You've got 14 different species you're working with, and each species reacts differently to the helicopter and things like that. So, and a lot I found that the animals here in Africa, there's specific species like common reedback, inyala, impala, and things that are very susceptible to capture myopathy. So you've got to be really careful with them, because otherwise you can, cause too much stress and they can start dying. So, whereas America, the flying conditions are a lot more difficult. You're flying, up in Utah where we work a lot, and up in the Rockies and things, you can be catching some mountainous terrain all the time, very steep, very rugged. Bighorn sheep country is very rugged. You're catching on little areas 30 feet and then 1,000 foot drop off. And if you smack your blades inside of a rock, I mean, it's not going to be pretty. You're not going to walk out of it. So flying conditions are a lot tougher in North America, and obviously it's a lot colder. We're working up in the snow. You've got to watch out for whiteouts, and you've got to make sure that when you set the helicopter down, that you don't get dynamic rollover and all sorts of different things in the thick snow. You don't sink back and get your tail out of that. It's definitely more challenging. But the animals themselves are pretty, when it comes to capture myopathy, they handle it a lot better. So, and there's fewer species there to catch. So those are the main differences. So yeah, between the two. And also the other thing, getting back to the pilot workload, when you're catching in a place like North America, you've got your crew out in the hills, you know, because we can be catching animals up to 12,000 feet up there, which I didn't mention. So, and, you know, you're leaving your crew in the side of the hill and you've got biologists somewhere else in the hill and you're slinging animals back and then the weather's coming in and you've got to coordinate getting the animals, when to call it, you know, when to pick up your crew, not to leave anybody in the side of the hill. The guys in when you're catching in North America, they all wear these, what we call a mugger's vest. And we carry survival gear inside those vests, you know, to be able to, you know, have one of those blankets, and we've got fire lighting equipment and all sorts of things in the event that, you know, they get stranded in the mountain. So, yeah. Whereas in South Africa, we don't have that issue because you're normally on a reserve and something goes wrong, a 2-minute drive, you know, somebody's at you. So.
Wow. Okay. What an amazing insight into that and also the dangers of the job. Yeah, it goes without saying, this is a pretty dangerous occupation. But on to my next question, and for all of the aviation enthusiasts out there, Mike, perhaps you could tell us a little bit about the helicopters that you use. I imagine some are better for different types of terrain or jobs than others.
Sure. So here in South Africa, we use a lot of reciprocating engine helicopters, a piston helicopter. Basically, the more common helicopters here are your Robinson R22, R44, and then the Hughes 300. Some guys will use turbine helicopters. South African National Parks, they have turbine helicopters. Obviously, they've got more power. You can put more people in. They're doing a lot more anti-poaching where they've got to get, you know, tracking dogs and anti-poaching crew into a helicopter, 4 or 5 people. So the reason the 22s and 44s are used here in South Africa is it's a cost thing, really. I've got to be careful what I say, but it is, because obviously a lot of the work is private, you know, and obviously helicopters are very expensive. And, you know, on a capture, it's probably the most expensive component, you know, anywhere from 4,500 to 6,500 rand an hour to operate a helicopter. So the Robinson 22 is a great little helicopter for mass capture. You can dart out of them, but, you know, and I've done it many times. I've net gunned out of it many times at altitudes of 5,000, so which is not ideal. You know, you're really working on the edge, so you've got to make sure you're working in cooler temperatures when the helicopter's got more power and an M. So, but the 22 is a great little machine for mass capture. You know, one pilot herding a bunch of animals into Burma works really well. And then when you come to the darting animals, a 44 is great. So you've got the pilot in there, you've got the veterinarian behind you, you've got the extra power because it's a bigger motor. You've got, you know, seats at the back where you can put his dart gun on, his drugs and everything like that. And then in the States, we use also 22s, 44s, and then MD-500, which is probably the, you know, the Ferrari of helicopters and the ultimate wildlife capture helicopter. So the 22s are used kind of in South Texas, you know, for a lot of the deer capture and some of the exotic capture, you know, because it's less than 1,000 feet and they can handle the power at those low altitudes. And again, 44 for the same reason. And then we use 44s up in the northern states at higher altitudes too. We use the Raven 2 because it's got a fuel injected engine, so it's got more power at altitude. But again, they're limited. Once you get to about 7,500 foot density altitude, you can start feeling the lack of power. So, and then we kind of switch over to the turbine. I'm actually pushing more to use the MD-500s, you know, no matter what we're catching, just because it's a dangerous job. And anything, you know, once you start catching wildlife, you know, oh, let's catch here, you know, can we catch a little bit higher? You want a collar put out over there, and you're always pushing the limits. You know, then obviously also, you know, without getting too technical, basically you've got your three H's, you know, high, hot and heavy. So when you're catching in North America, you've got altitude, weight, which we can manipulate, but the weather we can't control. You know, some days it's really nice and cold. Helicopter's got so much more power. You know, you come to the same capture a week or two later and suddenly the temperature's higher and you're just limited to what you can do. Mm. So having the MD-500 being a turbine, basket gear, short blades, short tail cone, you can get into tight spaces, you can work at higher altitudes, it's a safer machine, you can pick up more animals in a sling. So those are the three main helicopters, four, including the Hughes 300 that are used in wildlife capture. Occasionally, when we're slinging big animals like young elephant and rhino in a lot of these projects here, they'll bring in like the Huey, 412s, Bell 412s, big, really strong twin turbine engines to carry a big animal like a rhino. But that's very seldom. So, yeah, those are the helicopters that are used here.
Okay. And it's clear you have a huge passion for this job. Mike, what's the best thing about this job for you? I mean, it's a job that people must look at and think, wow, that is the dream. So yeah, what's the best thing about it?
How would I answer that? I mean, I love the aspect of everything. I think it's a little bit, wildlife capture, it's like little boys with big toys or big boys with big toys. I mean, you've got everything that, growing up as a kid, I mean, you've got helicopters, you've got big trucks, you've got crane trucks, and you've got, all that, equipment that you use for the capture, which is so impressive and it's so awesome. And then you've got, the wildlife itself, being out there in these beautiful habitats and beautiful conservation areas. You're working with the wildlife, getting your hands on animals that most people never ever get to see, right up close, either through binoculars or you're sitting on the back of a Gambier. We catch, in North America, we actually catch in some wilderness areas where anything with a motor, whether you've got a toothbrush, it's, got a battery, it's not allowed on there. I mean, helicopters and cars and vehicles can, we get special permits that we go into places that are just absolutely, it's hard to explain. It's just exquisite. They're beautiful. And you actually, some of these areas are so big. You feel so insignificant flying in your little helicopter. You think you need a big deal, but yet it's so massive. And if something goes wrong, you're just in the middle of nowhere. I think it's an excitement and appreciation of it all. And, a lot of the people we work with, there's some fantastic biologists out there and scientists and wildlife veterinarians. It's just, I think it's a combination of everything, just the equipment we work with, environment, the species. There's some days I actually pinch myself, there's days that are, you get frustrated because things aren't going your way, and the animals just aren't doing what you want them to do, and the weather, and then there's days you just feel absolutely privileged that we're doing something that most people don't do, Yeah, there's just so much about it that I love. It's hard to just pinpoint, specific things. So
yeah, and this is a last question. You mentioned about the experience needed on the ground before specialising as a helicopter wildlife capture specialist. Now, I'm sure there are some people out there who perhaps are really, really keen to give this career a go. What advice would you give to them if they were starting out?
Sure. I mean, and it's always great getting young people into wildlife conservation and getting into this career. Some places like here in South Africa, it's a little bit more forgiving. You can, join a wildlife capture crew, whether you're driving a truck or you helping put up a boma, running sails and curtains, working as a veterinary assistant, driving, delivering his animals and being there just to help him on the ground. It's best to start off that way, just getting your foot in the door and learning and asking questions, not trying to be a big deal, just absorbing it all, being respectful of the people you're working with, having a positive attitude, going through it that way, because you can start climbing the ladder, so to speak, and getting more responsibility and understanding more and learning more, getting that experience. We will have guys that have worked in the wildlife industry. I'll just give you an example. Some of my crew that work with me from here in South Africa, and, we get their work permits and take them across to the United States. They've grown up in game capture families, where their fathers have caught wildlife capture and their fathers, be wildlife capture pilots. So they're fortunate. So we draw on that experience. But for the youngsters, it's, go and meet people like that. Go and network, be part of a capture crew, And once you start developing that experience, you know, people like ourselves that are looking for experienced people, oh, we'll hear about you. Oh, there's this guy. You know, you've been working for the past 3 or 4 years in the capture, and, you know, people are talking about you, and or just, you know, put out some emails, make some phone calls, that sort of thing. So I encourage them to do that. So, I mean, even with the net gunning, you know, and working in the States, they want highly experienced people. You know, they don't want to be a training field. But sometimes they will give a person that's got wildlife experience, like I've just explained, an opportunity to dry field, like pack nets, start mugging, getting behind the net gun, and we build them into it. So, and then to become a pilot, it's the same story. It's like in Australia, they want you to work the ground first, work with the cattle first for a couple of years, learn it, and then get in. So same deal with the wildlife capture. And then get your pilot's license, you've got a good experience, people know that you've got the ground experience. And it's also, you've got to have a passion for it. You really do have to have a passion, because it's hard work and long hours. It's not easy work. There's times where you're driving through the night, working through the night, early hours of the morning. So that's what, I encourage your youngsters just to, you know, get into it that way. So they'll have some doors open, they have some doors closing. Persevere. It's nothing like, you know, just persevering in life. You'll get what you want.
Oh, what a great message. And I'm sure people have completely lit up listening to this behind the scenes view into a very, very niche job. But Mike, thank you so much for your time. And from everyone and all of our listeners, we'd like to say a massive thank you for your insight into this world today. It's been completely fascinating.
No, thank you, Amy, very much. You know, it's greatly appreciated, and it's nice to be able to talk about it for those people that don't know about it, and like you say, also for the youngsters that are trying to get into the field. It's difficult to get into, but absolutely give it a good crack. So no, thank you, Amy.
Well, I'm sure if you were dehorning a rhino today and darting a cheetah, I'm sure you'll be doing something equally as interesting tomorrow. So best of luck with that.
Yeah, I hope so. Obviously, with this whole corona thing that's, you know, put everything on hold, things are a little bit quiet. We are doing essential work, so you know, the species we work with, but we'll get through the rest of the season, do some great work. I know we've got some elephant collaring to do coming up and some mass capture and whatnot, and then it's off back to America to start the season there. So look forward to it all, as always.
Well, thank you so much again, and I'm sure everyone's going to be super interested to follow your work. So best of luck with everything in the future. You've listened to this wildlife podcast. Please do check us out on Instagram and Facebook by searching for This Wildlife Podcast. You'll find loads of photos and links to our incredible guests. And watch out for some awesome competitions coming up soon. Now, of course, our main priority is to share the conservation stories that must be told. And we need your help to grow the wildlife family and spread the word. So please do subscribe to the podcast, and if you're listening on Apple, we'd love it if you could leave us a review. Or if you're listening on another platform such as Spotify, how about you share us with a friend? So from everyone at This Wildlife Podcast, thank you so much for your support, and remember, we're here to bring the wild to you.